This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Well, not long ago, vast tracts of the Russian subarctic were covered in permafrost. That has now turned into wet bogland, the result of global climate change, which is creating significant problems for industry in the area.
And at that point, it's completely out of our control, and in the sense that even if the humans stopped emitting more greenhouse gases, the release of the trapped carbon material in the tundra just runs away.
Gas pipelines in Siberia are rising right out of the ground, while in Alaska, oil pipelines sag. Houses and factories built on permafrost are tipping. Under the whole North, land is becoming unstable as the climate warms. I'm Alex Smith. We're going to find many answers to a simple question. What happens if the permafrost thaws? I attended a conference session on that very subject with expert scientists at this year's meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science. We'll hear the latest. But it was rough going. After the session, which was technical and carefully hedged with scientific doubts, I ran into the soil expert for the European Union, Luca Montanarella. I told him, in spite of all I'd heard, I still didn't know, should we be worried or not? You'd like to worry, wouldn't you? Luca replied. But we have many more things to worry about now, further south. Of course, Luca is Italian. There were riots in the streets of Italy. The government had fallen and the banking system might soon follow. In the course of preparing this program on permafrost, I ran into as many opinions as experts. The permafrost may thaw over hundreds of years. The carbon stored there will come out slowly, one said. Another suggested that when the thaw comes, it will already be too late for our civilization, ruined by a changed climate further south. Other scenarios predict 50% to 80% of permafrost will thaw during this century. Maybe the released greenhouse gases will only equal 10 or 20 years of our current emissions, one of our guests says. Only. Another brand new scientific paper suggests permafrost melt may have caused the greatest mass extinction of 55 million years ago. We've never seen it. The frost was supposed to be permanent, and has been during all our human time on Earth. Now the signs of big changes are around the Arctic. What is coming? We can only model the future with very imperfect tools and guess the rest. Before we go into our interview with Canadian scientist Antony Lefkovitz, let's tune up with this short clip from the BBC.
Well, not long ago, vast tracts of the Russian subarctic were covered in permafrost. That has now turned into wet bogland, the result of global climate change, which is creating significant problems for industry in the area. Oleg Boldarev joined a scientific expedition in western Siberia to see the problem at first hand.
Looking for hard data in very soft ground. A researcher walks over a swamp to collect samples of lake water in the tundra laying above Russian permafrost. There are more and more of such swamps and lakes. And here is what worries scientists most. Methane, a greenhouse gas 20 times more powerful than CO2. The bubbles may be small, but the new lakes are emerging everywhere. Satellite images show the formation of new lakes. On the ground, samples need to be taken from lakes of different size and age. Dark, peaty water in this baby lake warms up under the sun, and so the melting begins.
Well, this is how it starts. The shallow depression in the ground is the beginning of a new lake, the lake which will be growing. And as it grows, it will release more and more methane. The same thing happens all over western Siberia. Now, 60% of Russian area is covered by permafrost, and the amounts of methane which are now stored locked underneath the surface are said to be around 80 billion tons.
Opinions differ on how much gas escapes each year. But it's a spiraling process. Once in the sky, methane aggravates global warming, and so even bigger areas of tundra get covered by lakes. All this may mean bad news for Russia's main industry. Underneath this seemingly untouched land run huge gas pipelines. And here's one of them, pushed onto the surface by shifting unstable ground. Unofficially, there is talk of increasing accidents like this, though on the record, Russia's Gazprom says its operations are not affected. But according to some researchers, the best case scenario means simply having enough time to adapt to the new environment.
It's taking place now, and we are too late, to my mind, with decision making, because this process was started, and now we have not any opportunity to stop it. We have only a time to delay it, maybe, to make the results less horrible.
70 years ago, cities and industries of the Russian North were literally drilled into permafrost. Back then, things indeed seemed permanent. But now this wobbly ground may become a symbol of new, unpredictable climate conditions for the world's largest country. Oleg Boldarev, BBC News.
I think before we dive into expert-level testimony about the latest science, let's start with a more user-friendly Radio EcoShock interview.
Radio EcoShock.
When we think about planet Earth, we don't picture a frozen planet. But a huge area underground is always icy. We call it permafrost. You won't find it in your backyard unless you live in the far north. Geologists and other scientists have only begun the task of cataloging this vast underground world. Now, as Earth warms, we all need to know about it, because if all the carbon locked up in the north is released, our climate and maybe even our civilization will change beyond recognition. Professor Antony Levkovich is a central figure unraveling this mystery. From the Department of Geography at Canada's University of Ottawa, Levkovich studies, leads doctoral researchers, and advises international groups on permafrost. He's a co-author on a new paper on the impacts of climate change on permafrost in Canada. Tony, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Well, you study places that are lightly inhabited, few people are around, it's seldom covered in the news we get every day. Before we get to your new scientific paper, I have to ask you, why should the public care what happens to the permafrost?
Well, I guess there are three reasons. The first thing is that permafrost can be a good thermometer. So unlike climate, which we register in the air, so when we register air temperatures over the long term, of course we get big year-to-year fluctuations. But if you go a little bit further into the Earth, you get a much longer-term signal without those fluctuations. So permafrost can act as the proverbial canary in the coal mine, indicating that indeed the North is warming. And, you know, sometimes in recent years there's been some controversy about whether climate change is really happening. And I would put it to you that permafrost doesn't know how to lie. It's not in big cities. It's not being affected by urbanization. It's not being affected by agricultural change. And so when permafrost says the climate's warming, it's got to be telling the truth. So that's my first point. The second one is that, as you pointed out, the carbon issue, that's really going to affect people all over the world. Really, the jury is out at this point to know whether there is going to be large emissions of carbon into the atmosphere. We do know, and we have learned just in the last few years, that there are massive, massive stocks of carbon locked up in the permafrost. But how long it'll take to thaw is another big question, and that's something we may want to come back to later. And the third point is it costs you. At least in Canada, where we have a federal government, that federal government is putting lots of money into the Northern Territories, the Yukon, the Northwest Territories, and Nunavut. And some of that money is going to stop permafrost thaw or to deal with the effects of permafrost thaw. There's a section of the Alaska Highway going through the Yukon to Alaska itself, which in fact the U.S. government has put a lot of money into too, to keep the highway up. And if you're within about 100 kilometers of the border with Alaska, you'll go through a series of ups and downs and lefts and rights on that road that are being caused by the permafrost beneath it thawing out. And it's costing tens of millions of dollars each year to upkeep that road.
Yes, well, we've got whole villages and towns built right on this ground that's presumed to be frozen. We've got pipelines crossing it that may be going up and down. Can you talk to us about that?
Sure. As you say, coastal erosion is a big problem, particularly in Alaska, but we think it might become more of a problem. Most of the settlements are on the coast in Canada as well, and so we've got Tuktoyaktuk is a problem of coastal erosion. And all around the northern coast of the Beaufort Sea and into the Bering Straits, you've got problems of erosion in Alaska. Whereas you say villages which were built on the coast because the First Nation peoples or the local inhabitants were dependent largely on fishing, and now we've got major, major rates of coastal erosion taking place. Sometimes it's difficult for us to tease out whether really things are accelerating or whether they've always been going on like that. But it's pretty obvious that if we have a longer ice-free season in the Arctic Ocean, that overall we're likely to get bigger wave, more storminess. All of those things are predicted anyway under climate change. And so you get more erosion. And the soil, because it gets washed away by a combination of wave action and thawing, just as the, if you imagine a block of ice with soil suspended in it thawing, well, there isn't much left after you've thawed it. And that's the kind of thing that's happening, which can lead to rates of erosion of tens of meters a year in some cases. So even if you had your house, you know, back a few hundred meters from the coast, as if it gets eaten away at tens of meters a year, it does tend to focus your mind on issues of coastal erosion.
Right. And how deep does this frozen soil, how deep does the frozen ground go, and how long has the plant material been building up in that?
It's very variable. If you go to the far north of Canada, and that's one of the things that's in our paper, is it compares across the different conditions in permafrost. So in the far northern tip of Canada at Alert on Ellesmere Island, the permafrost is several hundred meters thick, probably 500 to 700 meters in thickness. And its temperature is at about minus 15. But if you go south from there, the permafrost gets warmer and it gets thinner. And in the far north, it's continuous. So it's everywhere under every part of the landscape. And as you go south, as it gets warmer and thinner, it begins to break up. So if you like, it's like a jigsaw puzzle in the south. We're missing a whole bunch of pieces as you're putting it together, whereas in the north, the picture is complete. And similarly, it's thick in the north and thinner in the south. So in some parts of permafrost, the organic material has been accumulating for thousands of years. That's particularly true in parts of Alaska that weren't glaciated in the last glaciation, which ended about 10,000 years ago or so. And so for hundreds of thousands of years, we had slow buildup of aeolian material, windblown material on the surface, and then the grass kind of grew through that and stabilized it. And then as the surface gradually rose through many, many years, the permafrost, which was down at a depth of about 70 or 80 centimeters, rose with it. So it gradually incorporated that material that was being buried at the surface, went into the permafrost. And through time, that organic material was then preserved, just like in your freezer. You've got food in there that's carbon that's being preserved by the cold temperatures. And so in parts of Alaska and Yukon for many, many tens of thousands of years, and similarly in large parts of Russia, that's the case as well, because it was so dry during the last glaciation in those areas that there were no glaciers. Instead, it was a steppe landscape, a landscape with the woolly mammoth and all those great things that the great quaternary Pleistocene animals that roamed around in the Arctic 100,000 years ago.
We're talking with Professor Tony Levkovich, and I'd like to get down to your paper that was published in the Canadian Journal of Earth Sciences, also known as CJES. Please tell us the title of the paper and maybe just a very brief bit about your co-authors.
Well, the paper is called Climate and Ground Temperature Relations at Sites Across the Continuous and Discontinuous Permafrost Zones in Northern Canada. And my co-authors are Jennifer Troop and Sharon Smith. And Jennifer Troop is a former graduate student of mine. In fact, she was co-supervised, a master's student, with Sharon Smith, who is at the Geological Survey of Canada. And Sharon, for many, many years, has been taking readings across Canada in terms of her work for the Geological Survey. And Jenny then came and worked with the two of us in Ottawa for a couple of years during the International Polar Year, which ended in 2009. And as part of that, we developed and put in new boreholes to measure permafrost temperatures. And then we were able to use as well the long-term boreholes that have been maintained by the Geological Survey to put together a paper that really looked across all the permafrost zones.
And what were some of the conclusions you reached?
Well, I guess the first thing was the most obvious one, which was that permafrost is really climatically dominated at the scale of the continent. So what I described earlier, how it's so cold in the north and so much warmer in the south, really came out in this project. So we have ground temperatures that literally minus 15 up to just fractionally below zero. So we have some permafrost that's nearly gone or is perhaps in the process of going and everything in between. And it's very rare to have all of those data in a single paper because mostly people work in a given geographical area. And this way we were able to, through putting together a lot of information over acquired over many years and at huge cost, as you can imagine, we were able to get a picture sort of across the continent.
Well, you know, I've been following some of the reports of melting permafrost in Siberia, too. There's a fascinating video on YouTube of thousands of new shallow lakes, some small, some large, that are just popping up across northern Russia. You can even see them from space or on Google Earth. Is the same thing happening in Canada and Alaska?
I don't think it's happening to the same scale as in Russia at this point. We do have very strong warming, particularly in the Mackenzie Valley, of the western part of northern Canada, where we see temperatures increasing by even as much as a degree Celsius in a decade. And we are seeing in the southern fringes there places where peatlands in particular, where there is permafrost present in the peat and then not in the adjacent small ponds, some of these peatlands are decaying relatively rapidly. And again, you can see that through looking at satellite photos or air photos taken over decades or years. But the idea of large numbers of ponds being created in a short time, it doesn't seem to be happening yet in North America. And it's not absolutely clear why that is the case, but we don't seem to have quite the same level of impacts. But we are certainly seeing changes through time. We, as part of the International Polar Year, we redid a survey along the Alaska Highway from Whitehorse down into northern British Columbia. And this is a zone of permafrost that we call the discontinuous zone, so it's only present under certain parts of the landscape. And in fact, it's the warmest part of the discontinuous zone. So in fact, it's probably present in maybe less than 10% of the landscape. And the other 90% is just like your backyard in southern Canada or the United States. So in other words, the ground is frozen in the winter but thaws all the way through in the summertime. In this part of the territory, we were able to show that comparing a survey that was done in 1964, that about half the sites that were found in 1964, when even then there wouldn't have been that much permafrost around, but half of those sites no longer have permafrost. And so we're able to see that over multi-decades anyway, there have been significant changes to the distribution of permafrost in that southern fringe. On the other hand, if we go all the way up to Alert, the northernmost point in Canada, the permafrost today is at minus 14 or minus 15, and a decade ago or several decades ago, perhaps it was a degree colder, slightly colder than it is today. So what we're seeing there is not thawing, it just has warmed slightly. And so that's the kind of different impacts that we expect to see across the permafrost world. If you take your frozen turkey and you turn up the temperature on your freezer by 1 degree, the turkey is still frozen because it's at minus 15 and it's gone to minus 14. But if you take that turkey out and put it on the side on your kitchen counter, you know it's not going to stay frozen for all that long.
Right. Parts of it will stay frozen for a while on the inside, but the outside's melting.
That's right. And actually, the fact that it does take a while to melt, to thaw, is an important point. And I'm going to use some science speak now just to correct one of your uses there. We like to say thaw, not melt. As somebody said to me, if you thaw your turkey, you still have it to eat. If you melt your turkey, there's nothing left to eat. So we use thaw rather than melt because melt refers to only the ice, and permafrost doesn't necessarily have ice in it. It can just be made of rock with no water in it at all. Permafrost is defined by the temperature, so it has to be below zero for 2 or more years. But apart from that, we can go from everything from nearly pure ice right the way through to pure rock, and we definitely don't melt the rock.
I definitely did not know that. So what are some of the factors which determine the amount of greenhouse gases that come out as the permafrost thaws?
Last week I was at a conference, and a post International Polia Conference in Montreal, and I attended a number of sessions that were looking at carbon and permafrost and carbon emissions in general. This is the hot topic right now in permafrost research, and it's partly the hot topic because we don't have firm answers yet. As I said earlier, we know we have lots of carbon there. How much is going to be released and how fast it will be released is the key question. So what my understanding of all this is that when you have carbon without water, so you have aerobic conditions, basically that carbon will break down and release carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. If you have anaerobic conditions in which you have a wetland, a flooded area, then what you will release is potentially a combination of carbon dioxide and methane. And methane is a much more powerful greenhouse gas, that's CH4, than carbon dioxide. So a big question for us that is yet unanswered is what proportion of methane will be released versus the proportion of carbon dioxide? And it's difficult to answer that because that depends partly on what happens to the landscape. You talked earlier about ponds. So generally speaking, when we have water bodies, we will get methane released. But if we just get a drier type landscape, we may get carbon dioxide released. So on the one hand, it's that partitioning between carbon dioxide and methane that is unclear but is crucial. And the second part is really how fast will it happen? And that also depends partly on water. Water is a pretty efficient transmitter of heat down into the ground. So if we start to get a pond, then it tends to transmit the heat into the surrounding area, which then, again, begins to thaw. The ice melts. And if the ice melts, well, that landscape's going to collapse because there's no longer anything supporting the soil particles. So a pond can grow through time, as you described. So we could sort of get a feedback effect in which the initial formation of a pond creates a larger pond, creates a larger pond, creates a larger pond. And each time that happens, or as that's happening progressively, we're getting methane released. On the other hand, in other sites, maybe we'll just get a slow settlement of the ground surface, no ponding, and a slightly deeper thawed layer during the summertime, which means that some of that carbon may get released as carbon dioxide and may have a much more limited impact. So I don't think we have the answer yet, but what we know is it's a really, really serious question.
Right. So we've got how much is there, what form will it take as it comes out, and then how fast will it come out? And that is a huge question for many of us. I mean, we were told that the Arctic sea ice would remain solid until the year 2100, and now we have predictions of an open Arctic sea in September, at least as early as 2015. We don't know. But I'm wondering, is that same fear of speed up happening with the permafrost thawing?
I think we do have that concern. I don't think there's really a tipping point because that sort of implies that after this moment everything goes belly up. But I think we do think that the possibility of accelerated change is a real one. We know that permafrost is thawing, and we've got evidence of that I just mentioned earlier. And there are other studies around the Arctic, similar to the kind that we've done, that shows that permafrost is disappearing. We know there's lots of carbon. So by definition, that carbon must be becoming more available to the atmosphere. But how fast it will happen, still, as I said, we're not absolutely sure. But because it's positive feedback, just like the Arctic ice is positive feedback, as the ice goes on the ocean, so we get more energy absorbed, so then the ice goes faster. And permafrost has the potential to do that, that if we get a warming planet, as we continue to warm the planet, I should say, the permafrost itself will begin to thaw faster, and that could release more carbon to the atmosphere, which in turn will cause the warming to accelerate. And I think there's another very important point, which is a bit like the Arctic sea ice. It's difficult to imagine how we can revert back to a previous condition. It's actually quite difficult to thaw ground, but it's also very difficult to freeze ground. So if we have ice that's present in the permafrost and we have a raised peatland where right now most of the peat, which is organic matter, is locked up in that frozen soil, once we thaw it, I don't know how we're going to freeze it again. So I do see that very much as a one-way ticket. So once we start on it, I can't see how we can really stop it.
Right. There isn't a geoengineering solution for that one.
Not that I can think of. I did have somebody write to me once and said drop a whole bunch of thermosiphons which extract heat from the ground and drop them all over the tundra. He wanted a sort of forest of thermosiphons. But that isn't going to work because all you do is pump energy into the air.
We're talking with Professor Anthony Levkovich from the Department of Geography at the University of Ottawa. I attended a 3-lecture workshop on permafrost at the latest meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, and I came away with the impression that the whole subject is still in its infancy. Would you say that's true? And if so, what do we need to focus on first?
I don't think permafrost is really in its infancy because we've had studies that go right back to the 19th century. The first permafrost work was done in Russia in the 19th century when they were drilling holes to try and look at it. And in fact, we also know a lot about it. The miners in the Klondike, in the gold rush in the Yukon in 1898, also had to deal with permafrost. And they discovered how to deal with it. They thawed their way down through it fires. They deforested the entire landscape in order to create pits that they could go down through the permafrost to reach the frozen gravels underneath that had the gold in it. So people have been coping with permafrost for a long time. However, what I can tell you is that when I was a graduate student about 30 years ago, there wasn't a huge amount of interest in permafrost. There was because of resources in the north, but over the following 15 years or so, fewer and fewer people seem to be interested. But in the last 15 years, there's been a huge uptick in interest for the kind of reasons that we've been talking about already. The problem is we don't necessarily have the people, in North America at least, who really have worked their careers on permafrost, who've created, who have supervised graduate students. So we have a bit of a knowledge gap there, and it's largely through changes through time that society has become more interested in the subject as a result of global warming and as a result of the changes we're seeing in the Arctic. But if we go back 20 years, I would have been hard-pressed to have a radio interview.
Have you seen some good research? Who would you recommend coming from the Russians or the Europeans or other places on this subject?
Well, the Russians have a great deal of experience, but not a huge amount of money to put into it. What's happened, however, is that they've exported some of their best scientists to the U.S. And, for example, Vladimir Romanovsky, who is at University of Alaska Fairbanks, is one of the top permafrost researchers globally. Nikolai Shiklomanov, who is at George Brown University, is a mid-career scientist who's also making waves. So what we've actually seen is that the Russians who really have get up and go have become Americans.
What do you personally find the most interesting about permafrost?
I think it's the following. In theory, permafrost should be a very simple process and system to understand. It's purely driven by energy fluxes, energy in, energy out. So you'd think that we'd understand it by now. It's not a very complex system at the energy level, but it turns out that at the landscape level, it's incredibly complex, and we still don't fully understand what's going to happen to the future of it, as we've said many times. I can go to a site in the Yukon, and I could probably tell you 9 times out of 10 whether there's permafrost present at that site just by looking at it, looking at the vegetation that grows there, looking at where it is in terms of elevation, looking at whether there's water present and what the soils look like without even digging a pit. But if you ask me to predict that from remote sensing, from a satellite image, I'll probably be wrong most of the time. So our brains are actually pretty good at assessing conditions, but for some reason we're not able to transmit that yet into reliable methods that can work from space, unlike glaciers or sea ice. And we're still not able to predict the future of it in the long run with a high degree of confidence at the landscape level. We can often do a pretty good job at the individual site, but not telling you what's going to happen all the way across the north.
Well, that's a challenge. And I guess you've heard scientist Rob DeCanto just published an article in the journal Nature suggesting melting permafrost may have caused the great mass extinction around 55 million years ago. What did you think of that?
Well, I certainly read that with interest, but that was taking the global scale definitely for permafrost. So I don't feel competent really to discuss the actual science that's in that paper, but it certainly, again, it comes back to, is there the potential for this risk at the global scale? People ask me, well, is there still going to be permafrost left? And of course, the answer is there's going to be permafrost throughout our lifetimes. The question is how much will be left and what the impacts of the stuff that's thawing is going to have. And I think those ones we're still not sure of.
We've been talking with Professor Antony Lefkovic from the Department of Geography at the University of Ottawa. He's at the hub of Canadian research into permafrost. His latest paper, published in the Canadian Journal of Earth Sciences, describes the impact of climate change on this giant storehouse of carbon. And you can find more links at my blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much, Tony, for helping us out.
It's been a great pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock.